It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a common yet intriguing animal in western Wisconsin.
No matter where we live in Wisconsin, we share our community with birds. Writer Ron Davis of Eau Claire has been thinking a lot about his feathered neighbors lately, particularly the crows.
Sawdust City, Portland of the Midwest, and horseradish capital of the world. These are just a few of Eau Claire, Wisconsin's nicknames, but I've come to increasingly think of it as the Crow City. Is it just me? It seems that anywhere I go, there are crows, sometimes lots of crows. I hear them throughout the day, particularly at dawn when they begin rallying up for the day's quest for food. Some spilled French fries in the McDonald's parking lot, that squirrel pancaked on Water Street, or maybe a few squished blueberries from the farmer's market. But don't get me wrong. Apart from the raucous reveille in the mornings, I've got nothing against crows. True, the American crow is certainly not as glamorous as Eau Claire's famous eagle, Old Abe. Their caw can't be described as a song. And thanks to those haunting scenes in Alfred Hitchcock's adaptation of The Birds, crows even have a sinister repute. But I found that your basic crow actually has some pretty amazing qualities. I was recently birdwatching in Carson Park with Steve Bechkol of Eau Claire. He's an ornithologist, Emmy-winning video journalist, and author of 8 books on birds.
Well, if you're a fan of bird behavior, then you're a fan of crows.
I learned crows are one of only 4 species, including humans, that can fashion and use tools. Crows have the largest brain-to-body ratio of any bird, even bigger than ours, and the lowly scavenger has sometimes been called the chimpanzee of the bird world. Research indicates they can count as high as 16.
One of the reasons that crows are so successful is because they're so adaptive. They're omnivorous, so just about anything that has caloric value is fit for consumption. They're also not picky about habitat. They do require trees for nesting or roosting, but they're just fine if those trees are next to human habitation. Additionally, crows aren't migratory, so they don't face the kind of stressors that long-distance migrants do.
Crows are also very social and family-oriented. They mostly mate for life, and they often help raise fledglings for other crows' broods. Crows have their own language of more than 100 different calls, even different regional dialects. According to Bechkol, crows can even tell us something about ourselves.
Every bird is a success story, an example of a species that has been shaped over millions of years. And birds are indicators of environmental health. If the birds aren't doing well, that's a good indication that we're doing something to hurt their populations, and the data bear this out. Species that, unlike crows, are more sensitive to habitat disruption, free-roaming cats, migratory stressors, and environmental toxins are not doing well. Perhaps we should take a closer look at human behavior.
After living in the sticks for 40 years, I moved to Eau Claire 5 years ago. Besides the crows, I delight in any incursions of wildlife into my new neighborhood, whether it's the deer that sneak into our backyard at night or the squirrels that terrorize our bird feeders.
Eau Claire is, of course, a bird city, and that designation is beneficial for community. However, it's not a one-way deal, in my opinion. We owe birds something in return, a commitment to more conscientious and sustainable lifestyles which are bird-friendly. There's data out there that says that half the humans on Earth are born with a genetic propensity to love animals. What does that mean for the other 50%, I wonder? And how does that translate into everyday practice of compassion and empathy?
The crow may not be Eau Claire's official city bird, but perhaps any touch of wildlife in this city is something worth treasuring.
Ron Davis is a writer who lives in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Picture the scene. You're out on a lake and you see an island. Good size, lots of plants, maybe even some trees on it. Then you take a closer look. The island is moving.
That's a real-life scene on the Lake Chippewa flowage in northwestern Wisconsin, not far from Hayward. The islands are actually wetland bogs that drift slowly around the flowage.
Sometimes the bogs block off key waterways, and a group of community members get together to move the bog with their boats.
They're known as the Bog Pushers.
Cheryl Treeland is president of the Lake Chippewa Flowage Resort Association and retired owner of Treeland Resorts. She's one of the main organizers of the Bog Pushers. We started by talking about a bog the group recently moved. It has mature trees and weighs an estimated 200 tons.
It moves because the water is real high and because the winds are moving it. Once it gets moving, you can move it right along. When we moved that bog a couple weeks ago, we had probably 40 to 50 boats on it. And we were being directed with people with radios, and we had it three sides of it surrounded, and we were going great guns, and we had moved it probably, when it starts moving, you can actually see it moving. You're like, wow, you look at the shoreline, and you see that you are actually moving it, and you're making progress. Well, then a big gust of wind came up and deflated everything for us because it spun it around a good 30, 40 degrees from where we needed to take it through a channel to get it through, and we got it hung up on a rock bar. So it sat there for another almost 48 hours. And then we had another big storm two nights later, and that one blew out. And it's now over in a place that is no longer a navigation hazard.
Wow. Now, Cheryl, I want to ask, if I was out on the water in the flowage there, and I didn't know about these floating bogs, right? And if I looked at this one, especially this big one you talked about moving, I would think it's an island, right? I mean, plants and trees and stuff. It looks, to the untrained eye, like an island, right?
It does look like an island. People call them floating islands all the time, but they're not actually island because they're not land.
Right.
What you can do when you look at them, there's never a shoreline on a bog. There's never, as you look at an island, you typically see the topography going away from the shoreline. You know, you're going to get to the shoreline. As you go further back away from the shoreline, you see the trees getting higher. You might see, you know, higher off in the distance. When you look at a bog, everything is flat. So the trees, the bushes, everything's going to be the same level. As you look back at it, there's no topography, no change in the elevation, and there's never a shoreline unless it's washed up onto a shoreline, but the bog is not part of the shoreline.
And you mentioned a navigation hazard. If these bogs blow over to the wrong place, they can literally cut one part of the lake off from another part?
Yep. The Chippewa flowage is almost 16,000 acres of water. We've got 140 islands out there. And we've got over 200 miles of shoreline. We have only one spot on the whole Chippewa flowage, which is the bridge, which is right centrally located, north, south, east, west, is where the bridge is. And that's where these bogs are. They are on the west side. If they get blown in to the bridge, we become two lakes, all right? And everyone is so used to, even though it's a large lake, everyone's used to it, the size of outboards and stuff now. You know, if we were going back 50, 60, 70 years ago, it would not be the issue that it is because people weren't leaving their resorts, their vacation homes. They were not leaving and taking off and going, you know, 15, 20 miles across the lake. Nowadays, everyone hops in their boat and what used to be an all-day trek and like, you know, trip to the Antarctica or something when people left the resorts to make it down to the dam and back. It was an all-day affair. When they left, everyone wished them good wishes. They'd stop and have a shore lunch somewhere. But, you know, they're looking at maybe a 10-horse motor at the biggest, and they'd have three, four people and all their gear for the day in there. And they'd make it back, you know, before dark, and everyone would be down there to greet them. Did you find it? Did you find it? And all of this stuff. And it was quite different. Nowadays, with all of the boats and the size of the motors, it's even though the lake is large, it's made the lake a lot smaller.
When you need the bog pushers to swing into action, how is there a bat signal or what do you do to get people out and rallied and have their boats ready to rock?
Well, I retired in 2000 from being a resort owner. And so the first time after that we had to move the bog, I got a call from Denny because he's got the landing, which is right by the bridge. And he's the one that is affected by it because he's on the west side, in just north of the bridge, and the bogs really affect him. He can see it on a day-to-day, minute-by-minute. He can watch what's happening with bogs. And he says, Cheryl, because it was on, you know, an early Saturday morning, he says, the bog's blocking the bridge. He says, can you do something today? Because resorters on Saturdays don't have any extra time at all because it's a big changeover day. So Denny, I said, yep, I'll take care of it because I was retired now. I wasn't cleaning cabins and checking people in on Saturday. So I got on the phone. I just started calling other resorters, leaving messages there. I called campgrounds, left messages there. I called people on the property owners that are on the lake. And you just say, hey, we're going to meet at, I said, give me a time. He says, 3 o'clock today. I said, okay. So I just start putting the word out. Okay, 3 o'clock today, bring any boats you can. If you don't have a boat, come by car, stand on the bridge, because what we need to do when we push, we have to have weight in the front end of the boat so the boats don't just skid up on top of the bog, okay? So we get people that just, they wander down there, they become part of the bog pushers, and it becomes a big social event. We can have this one Tuesday a week ago, I think we had probably 40 to 50 boats there. And we probably had at least another 50 people that just showed up and bail into the boats so that we can hold down the nose of them as we start giving power to it to try to push it.
I love it. So I could, if I don't have a boat, I can show up and be ballast.
You better believe it. You would be up in the front end and you'd be just sitting there as we're going very little or nowhere. When we moved it a couple years ago in my boat, I looked down at one time. I said, we're actually going 0.7 miles per hour. And the guy who was next to me with his fishing boat with all the gadgets on it, he looked down, he goes, that's exactly what I have, 0.7 miles per hour. So it doesn't move fast, but when you're looking at shore, you can see that you are moving it and you know that it is going somewhere. But you got to have, the winds have to be right, water levels have to be right.
Talking to Cheryl Treeland, president of the Lake Chippewa Flowage Resort Association, about the floating bogs on the Lake Chippewa Flowage. Got to ask you, Cheryl, about the fishing there. Now, you have served as the Grand Marshal of Muskie Fest there, and some world record muskies have been caught. There's a little controversy. Can you tell us a little bit about muskie fishing in the flowage?
Well, muskie fishing is the world record fish caught by Louis Spray in 1949. It was 63 and a half inches long. That's 5 foot, 3.5 inches tall, just about what I am. And with 69 pounds, 11 ounces. I weigh a little bit more than that, though. Anyhow, that was one that was caught there. We also had some, Al Johnson caught a world record prior to that. That was the world record out of Lake Couderay, another lake right up here, close to the Chippewa Flowage. And but we have great fishing, great fishery out here. We have a lot of, the size limit is now 50 inches. And just about everyone in the muskie world now, everything is CPR. It's catch, photo, and release of these fish. And they're just fishing for the sport of it. So you're starting to see a lot of fish every year. We probably have, I'd say, about half a dozen that are caught that are over 50 inches that they're getting into the boats and CPRing and releasing. And but the fisheries are great, great muskie fishery, and we have several muskie tournaments here. This over the last year, they had the professional muskie trail tournament. Their final championship for the whole season four was on the Chippewa Flowage, and it was a very, very well fished, well tournament, good tournament for them because they did bring in lots of fish.
I got to ask a bonus question here, Cheryl. I distantly remember my teenage years. Me and my buddies didn't always have great judgment. I could see if we had a floating bog like this in the local lake, us going out and trying to, you know, hop out and, you know, hang out on it or something, which sounds like wouldn't work. Do you ever get people going out and thinking they're going to have a picnic or whatever on this floating bog?
No.
No?
You would pull up to it. They're great fishing areas as you get towards in the morning or in the evening. You see boats pull up to the bogs and they just grab some of the branches that are there from like the brush that grows on it and they tie their thing there. But because the bog is floating, it's always moving. So if a boat goes by, you see kind of this ripple effect of the whole bog as it moves up and down. But when it does that, all this stuff that's in the bog and underneath all the branches and everything underneath it that are underneath the water, it's great protection for the littler fish. You have the little stuff that falls off of the bog all the time, which is feed for the fish. And you basically, they're great fishing areas, but if you tried to step out on them, your foot, you'd go right down into a mass of tangled roots, black muck, and it would not be fun. If you had to get onto it, what you would probably do is get a pair of like water skis on. Get the bindings as big as you can get them, keep your tennis shoes on, and then that's enough to hold you up on top of the brush. If it's a developed bog, if it's a new bog, You wouldn't even do it with a, you know, this a mud flat. I wouldn't want to do it even with the skis on.
Cheryl, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
You betcha. Thank you.
Cheryl Treeland is president of the Lake Chippewa Flowage Resort Association. She's one of the main organizers of the Bog Pushers.